This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. We have a special guest today, Gil Figueroa. He is president of First Commercial Capital, Inc. He's got exceptional experience originating, underwriting, and closing multifamily and commercial real estate loans. Real estate broker since 1993 with in-depth knowledge of the apartment lending and commercial real estate and mortgage industries. Comprehensive knowledge of diverse and complex loan programs, escrow and title procedures, and loan documentation requirements. Outstanding ability in identifying mortgage loan opportunities and financial benefits for clients. Highly experienced financial analyst, wealth planner for high net worth individuals. Focused on delivering practical and effective investment strategies specifically tailored to meet investor financial and retirement objectives. Excellent communicator, professional speaker with over 9 years presenting at wealth conferences and seminars. And that's how he and I met. And to be honest with you, I've always enjoyed his presentations. And I would say one of the few people I take notes on every time I hear him speak. So that's pretty cool. So, Gil, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce, and all the accolades. I'm humbled.
Well, it's true. You know, it's kind of fun, especially when you get to into charts. You know, I'm so into charts. And, you know, whenever you start saying, hey, this is about to happen in real estate interest rates, and then it happens, is you've got my attention, man. So let's talk a little bit about, and the reason this is coming up, again, what I said to you off of the recording is that this is not something that I'm really familiar with, is commercial lending. And I'm trying to see what the ramifications are for the economy and so forth. And if there's some dominoes that are about to fall that I would like to need, I would want to know about. So let's go back to the 90s. 93 is in when you got into this business. Can you take me through the journey of interest rates from, let's say, back then to, you know, go through the journey with me about, you know, how high they were, and I know how low they got, but what's a range that occurred over, that's a long period of time. That's what, a long time.
Yeah, Bruce, I'll even take you back a little further. I actually started in the industry in 91 during the Gulf Wars, and everyone was excited when I called them with a single-digit interest rate.
There you go.
I had great timing getting in the market. So we, you know, the market was in the tens, and during the Gulf War, we dropped in nines. So hence started the refi revolution, so to speak.
And since then.
Yes. And since then.
Yeah. You know, so that's what's interesting. See, that's what's kind of in my mind, too, is that the residential journey has benefited from 40 years of interest rate reductions, basically. It's not been a straight line, but it's been excessive, 17% to 2.5 or something. That's a heck of a journey that keeps buffering the prices to give it another chance to run. So in your world, you know, that's why I was interested in the journey. You know, when you say 10%, and that sounds like a bargain, it's because you came off of the 80s when it wasn't 10%. That's for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. People were excited.
Now, if they saw a 10%, they'd flip out. And, you know, and that's part of what they're seeing now is they are flipping out probably. It may be double what they currently have. So, yeah, that's an eye opener.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, it's been unprecedented to have this many increases in 1 year in such a short term. So yeah, there's a shock to the system, obviously, and you know, our traction slowed down. So people have slowed down. There's a lot of deer in the headlights right now.
Yeah. So, what would you say the cap rate history was during that journey? So somebody said, okay, you know, I've got to have this. And then you go all the way to the 2020 and 21 mindset. What was the acceptable cap rate? And what was that journey like? It seemed like it probably would have come down a lot.
Well, I remember when I first started looking at investing in multifamily, we had almost double digit cap rates. Now, this is a time where California had a lot of jobs leave because of the airspace. I mean, the military and the different right. entities that kind of left California, and we were left in a kind of a void. And we had higher vacancies, 10-15%, and we had cap rates in double digits. I think that takes us to somewhere around the early 90s or so. And then we started the lower interest rate march, so to speak, and you saw cap rates compress, dropping. So I wouldn't say there's an average, but they've been dropping steadily for the last 20 years. They've been dropping and dropping and dropping. So at the low, we had caps probably in 21 at 3. I've seen 2.5 caps in the west side of Los Angeles. So in the higher premium areas, some brokers weren't even proposing a cap rate because they didn't have one. So we saw some Pasadena deals and some West Side Beverly Hills and Santa Monica deals without even promoting a cap rate, because it was, an inverse situation, so to speak.
Yeah, see, that's what's interesting. So, I mean, that world happens in residential real estate. So I'm very familiar with those charts. And does commercial, does it do it at the same time? Or is it in a different cycle? So I'll just go through when you got into to market, say 91, from 89 to 95 or 6, residential real estate didn't go up. It went a little bit down every year, but that was that chunk of time. After 96, that was when I wrote my first report with California Comeback, so prices will double. So residential started gradually going up and then got excessive. So what was the journey of commercial real estate, let's say from 91 to 96 and then from 96 to 06?
Wow, you're going to test my memory. What I do recall is 96 had foreclosures. We had a tough market. We had a tough market in multifamily. It was a tough market, and we had higher vacancies and higher cap rates. So I as far as my recollection, we didn't start getting into a positive, upbeat format to probably, I'm going to say 98, 99. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We started picking up aggressively, even through the dot-com, bust, we still kind of kept precedent and values were increasing. And then in 94, 93, we saw a big bump. And then we started a steady upward trend, or I should say downward trend in cap rates, upward trends in value.
Now, when you say dot-com, we're talking about the journey for it to go all the way up, or at that time where it broke, say 2000, 2001. So what happened to a commercial?
Yeah, it stayed steady. It didn't lose its short, so to speak. And we saw, more pickup, obviously, thereafter, and especially when the Fed started lowering rates aggressively during 2001 and forward, then we saw a tremendous pickup. We saw cap rates go from 8s to 6, even 5 quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. So that wasn't, that wasn't driven by a real estate problem. That was delivered, came about because of, let's say, an economic situation with the stock market and trying to stave off a recession. What happened after, say, 2007, when the real estate residential market just tanked, tons of foreclosures that had to feed people into apartments? So I wondered what the cycle was for that type of inventory.
Well, interesting enough, it did slow down during that period. I think it's just fear-based because it was a fundamental-based. So like you said, fundamentally, we had more tenants, we had more people looking for apartments, and we had lower rates. So our rates started to drop, during that period.
Right.
So, right before that, we were in the, sevens, and maybe we dropped to, those low sixes. So we had a nice drop. So fundamentally, it was sound. We had a little bit of a hiccup during 08, 09, and then a steady climb from then on. Very steady. People who bought in 09 did great.
So the residential price from peaked to trough, which was kind of bounced. 2009, 10, 11, and 12 were almost the same number for residential California. So you just still had damage mentally, and also just people's credit was all messed up. That price hit was over 50% from peak. So what was the journey from top to bottom? And I know that we're talking always, when we talk commercial real estate, it's always a different product. So apartments and office building, let's just use those two worlds. That how was damage different for both of those types of products?
You know, that's a good question. Frankly, I didn't prep for this, but my recollection is apartments dropped maybe 10%, not much, maybe 12%. I didn't see a tremendous drop. We still had demand in product. I think it was more of just fear-based situation, but the fundamentals were there, and we steadily climbed up, especially with rates dropping.
Okay. And office, now did office get hurt?
You know, not a big office lender. So we didn't, our market share was probably 85% apartments, some SBA, and some strip retail deals. So we didn't do much in office. We saw some softness, but again, based on my recollection, my flow of, as far as funding's concerned, office wasn't one of our big criteria. So I don't really have a handle on them.
Okay. Now, let me just make sure when we go forward, what is the product type that you've concentrated on, let's say, in the last 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, the product type that we are about 80 to 85% based in is multifamily. So multifamily. Over 5 units, typically under 100 units. That's been our kind of our farming, so to speak. It has a good turnover rate and accessible buyers, where, you know, some of the bigger product are hedge funds and so forth.
Okay. Yeah, some of my questions are going to be not in that world, but I'm trying to get a sense of what's next for the lender. So let's talk about who's the lender for the apartment building. Is it different from the lender of the office? Because I just wonder if the whatever's going to happen in the office space is going to kind of be a contagion to the rest of the portfolio of loans, that type of thing.
Right. Right. I think office is having a lot of issues because some companies did perform well during, you know, the COVID lockdown and had good metrics. Some people are coming back to the office and wanting their employees back in the office space. But right now, what's bullish for most lenders is multifamily and industrial. So they haven't picked up the bullish wand on office as of yet. At all. So I'm not seeing that as of yet. Not to say it won't come, because a lot of bigger firms are requesting their employees to come back to work and work at a desk and so forth, a stationary area. So it could come back. But my point is, office got hit not only with, you know, obviously other factors, but also with that COVID lockdown and not being able to go in the office. So it some balance sheets performed well and some others just performed mediocre, but some companies are still moving forward on the no office space model.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess my take would be office lending and office occupancy is going to be a problem. But I understand that what you're saying is the apartment world. Okay, let's talk about when you have the mindset of, I think I'll buy an apartment building at a 3 or 4 cap, and now things are changing. So what would be the impact of the cap rate, let's say now, and if the direction is less positive, you know, what would be a reasonable cap rate, and how does that impact value? And then how does that impact, I want to get a refi, and so I bought it at a 3 cap. What would you like to give me? You know, let's say, can I get the same loan amount, or am I adding capital at this point? You know,
That's a great question. So if you were, you know, getting lower, the lowest rates in town, so to speak, in the 2020 and 2021, we were selling rates in the low 3s, you know, very low 3. I think we sold one right at 3%. for 10-year money, you know, which was just phenomenal. Just phenomenal, you know. And if you're if you were leveraged, maximum leverage product, and you were looking for, you know, maximum DCR, which is 120 typically, you're the metrics will not work for a refi unless you do pay it down. So if you were maxed out, unless you raised rents accordingly to the increase in rates, so you had to be aggressive on your rental income. And if you were, then it might pencil for a 120 DCR. But in essence, if our rates went up, let's say 28%, well, your rents should go up 28% to keep up with that flow to be able to refi. That's the key question. And a lot of people couldn't do that because of COVID and all the restrictions and so forth.
Well, you know, you've just brought up another subject. So somebody that's holding the paper at 3%, do they have an asset that's no longer worth face value? And how does that impact the stability of the lending world for them?
Great question. So far, and I'll give you just a heartbeat of where we're at right now. So right now, I just had a conference call with a lot of big institutions, and one of them was Albert Brooks, who heads of Chase Multifamily Lending for all of all of California.
Okay.
And he said something that was pretty interesting, especially in this environment. He said that all of California multifamily have zero 30-day lates on their mortgages. And that was impressive to me. So
that is
where everyone
impressive.
So everyone is, you know, stating gloom and doom. Apparently, people are able to make their mortgages, and it's not just some people, it's everyone in their portfolio. So that's pretty powerful. Assuming
performance-wise. Absolutely.
Right, performance-wise. And a lot of people, you know, aren't leveraged out. So there was what you have to look at as far as, you mean, non-performing product line would be who actually went over leveraged between 20 and 21, you know, because if they were over leveraged in 19, they still bought in the high 4s or 5%. So chances are they're not going to be affected that much. So it's not such quite a big window. So when we got into 3%, you know, cap rate and 3% interest rates, those people are the ones that if they max leverage could have an issue and have to pay down potentially to refinance unless their rents kept up with the interest rate growth.
What about the actual value of the paper itself? Because that's what caused the problems with the banks. So I'm holding, because I'm sure you had clients refinance multiple times. As rates got into numbers they never even thought they would dream of, you probably gave them a call and said, would you like to go from a 4 to 3.25? And of course they'd say, I think I would do that. Well, now there's a lender that holds that paper, but in a market that's no longer that. So what is the value of their paper, and are they forced to mark to market?
Right. Well, I'm assuming just based on the complete, you know, the credit rating. Now, I know that's a precarious statement, credit rating, but I'm assuming because there's no 30-day lates, there's very few defaults, that's probably not going to come up as of now.
Well, I don't mean the default stuff. I'm talking about, what happened to the bank? They didn't have any defaults. They had 10-year T-bills, but they had 10-year T-bills at 1.2% in a market that was approaching 4%. So the mark-to-market of the 10-year T-bill wasn't face value.
Right.
It was very discounted. So that, I guess I'm not worried about the, I guess I'm thinking about, and I'm asking, because this is not my expertise. Is there somebody looking over, like an auditor for whoever is in charge of this, looking at their loan portfolio and going, wow, you have everything's current, but this is no longer worth $1 million. This is $1 million loan at 3% in a market that's now 6%. So do they extrapolate value and say you really have paper that's not worth very much? I'm just curious.
Well, fundamentally, what you're saying is logical, and they should. But I don't know the internals of that auditing to give you clarity on your question. On my assumption, I would assume that as long as it's performing, it doesn't become a problem. Now,
Why did a T-bill become a problem? See, I was kind of blown away by that,
right?
Because you're right. No one's late on a T-bill. So right.
That's fractional banking, right? So remember, when banks are lending, they're creating money. So they're creating money flow through lending, right? So right. As far as, you know, the banks that had the problem, they had too much liquidity and they didn't have a way to pay out their customers back because of the discrepancy of T-bills to, you know, where what the funds that they held. So there's the issue. Now, your logic does sustain to the point where people who bought in 20 and 21 that were over leveraged, couldn't increase rents, and didn't have a very good strategy to increase rents. Okay. So there is a group of people that might be injured, and these loans should be downgraded to a certain extent if there was some grading system that would account for that. Now, that being said, one thing that lenders are probably looking at and spooked about is that reset. So if you had a 5-7 year fixed on a short-term product like a LIBOR, well, LIBOR is almost at 5 today. Typical bank margins are 2.5. That's 7.5. Right. So if you captured a loan at 3.5 and all of a sudden you're going to get hit, which there are hurdle rates. Some lenders only allow a 2% or a 1% increase during that big adjustment period. Some don't. So my point is, eventually, if they don't refinance right now where rates are in the mid fives and they just allow the adjustable to continue, that rate could be in the mid sevens. So that's a drastic change. There's no way that property can perform unless they increase rents basically 60, 70%.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be an option. So they would have to either bring in cash to get the LTV to be at the lender's number, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. The debt service. Yes.
Okay. So there's a lot of that money coming due in the next 3 years.
There is. And more so, what I'd say is the most precarious position is the money that bought 3 cap rates, bought 3.5 cap rates, and bought a 3% interest rate. So that 20 to 21, you know, acquisition period, maybe even early 22, if they bought over leveraged, if they bought maximum leverage, I should say, at a 120 and haven't been able to raise rents, that's a precarious position. So there is a group of investors and funds that could be in a precarious position. Go ahead.
When you say 120, I don't know what that means. So you have to explain that to me.
Yeah. In simple layman's terms, a lender wants to see, after all expenses, right? So they take your gross rents, they use a vacancy factor, then they use all expenses you can imagine, including taxes, insurance, management fees, rehab fees, maintenance fees, and so forth. Then you have a net number. So that net number has to be 20% greater than your mortgage payment.
Wow. Well, that's pretty conservative lending.
That's commercial lending in a nutshell.
Okay.
And some lenders have even a higher threshold, a 130 or 135. Like office space typically has a 135, you know, where apartments might have a 120 per se.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Norse Group Real Estate Radio Show and Podcast. Join us next week for part two as Bruce talks commercial and multifamily lending with Gil Figueroa, president of First Commercial Capital, Inc.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.